It's Golden Hour Adventure Time, featuring everyday people doing extraordinary things. From the peaks of victory to the valleys of defeat, these are their stories. Now, from the back of the pack, your hosts, Justin and Robbie.
Welcome to Golden Hour Adventures. Today's guest is the one and only Justin Andres, fresh off his 100-mile race.
Yeah, fresh off. Just a couple days afterwards, if you want to call it. I guess it is a 100-mile race, that's for sure, but it does not feel like it was anything like a typical 100-mile race. I will tell you that, man.
Well, in true Golden Hour fashion, I didn't want to know anything about it, so I'm going to ask Justin. I didn't even look at his Instagram on purpose, so I know nothing, because I wanted to hear it out of his mouth, you know, firsthand. So the first question is, why did you pick this race?
Yeah, you know, I got that question a lot. And I don't really know why. I think it was kind of one of those things that, you know, I've done three 100s before. I've done multiple 50K, 50 mile, 100Ks. And so it's like, but all of them have been your typical trail, you know, lower 48 trail race. And so I saw that there's the winter ultras, right? And that, you know, living up here, having the opportunity to train in the environment, and, you know, it just seemed like a thing to do, right? Because it's right here in my backyard. Why not? You know, the trailhead to the race starting at the race was an hour drive. And so why not? I don't know. It's one of those things. It's, you know, it's just like, see how far you can push yourself and what's next. What's the next big challenge? And so, you know, the typical, you know, 100-mile races, and then you're, you know, okay, what's next after that? Maybe jumping into the 200 or the 48-hour. But, you know, I still think that I have more to give in the 100-mile and more to figure out in the 100-mile. And so I thought, you know, why not test the what's next type thing in a 100-mile race, but that's something that's out of my element, something that's out of most people's element, you know? And so, the Winter Ultra was born. At least for me. It's been around for a long time, but at least for me.
So you signed up for it and you're on the waiting list. Then how long before you knew that you were a go?
Yeah, so I was waitlisted number 11 when they did the lottery, I believe back in January. And the list did not move at all, maybe a person or two, until the week of the race. And I think it was Thursday with the race start on Sunday that I found out that I got in. It might have been Wednesday night, but it was Wednesday night, Thursday is when I found out that I got in. So, you know, I had heard that from other locals here that the wait list usually gets ran through all the way on the week of the race, which it did this year as well. Everybody that wanted to run the race that was waitlisted got the opportunity, to at least stand on the toe the line. But yeah, so I think it was Wednesday night, Thursday, sometime that I found out that I had gotten in. So I had been preparing to run the race, knowing the fact that the waitlist, I believe the last two or three years had gone all the way through. So I'd been preparing to run the race and, you know, somewhat training to to run it.
I mean, you've had quite the year already.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a wild year so far, and it's made it, I say, somewhat difficult to train for this race. You know, you and I, obviously the rest of the crowd knows that we started out at Bandera early January. I came back for like a couple of days, and then my wife ran Arches 50K in Moab, spent some time out there, came back for a couple weeks, and then I went to Korea for 3 weeks for a training exercise, back for a week, and then the race starts. So didn't really have the opportunity to put down big miles after Bandera, you know, taking your rest to recover from that and then jump back into training, knowing that a 100-miler is coming up. didn't have that opportunity to put down real big miles, but I was still putting down 30, 40 mile weeks, which I was definitely happy with. So, yeah, a little bit of odd training for me, something that not normally happens, but we were able to come away with a win. So that's what matters. Well, I did not win the race, let's be honest, but a win in my eyes is a finish. So yeah, we were able to come away with a dub. So
after Bandera, what did your training look like?
Well, I always take a week off after every race, almost a full week. I would say anytime, I would say 50 mile or bigger, just take a week off. Just give your body that time to heal. There's no reason to go and push it any harder than that, you know, then maybe doing some walks here and there, but nothing major, just no running at all, just a full week off. And then, you know, after that, like we're in Moab. And so, yeah, I'm definitely going out and exploring some of the trails when I had the chance to go out but nothing big, no long runs, you know, just a little 5-6 miler here and there, but came back. I think I got one 18 mile training run, probably a 40, 50 mile week that week, but one 18 miler on snowpack once we got back from Moab and, you know, body was feeling a little bit better. But like I said, then I turned around and went to Korea. So the training, I was doing lots and lots of walking in Korea. So that, I think that helped a lot. And then, you know, I think the longest I got was like a 10 or 12 miler. I was just extremely busy over there, so I didn't have a lot of time to dedicate to training, but, you know, still put down 40 mile week. So I'm definitely happy with that.
So you found out you got in Wednesday, Thursday. What was your thoughts going through your head when you finally saw your name as an entrant?
Yeah. So, you know, the race director is a friend of mine. So she messaged me. I think it's typically if they're not a known, you know, person, if she doesn't know them, she sends them an email. But I actually got a text message saying, "Hey, do you want in? You're up." And so me and my wife sent her a picture. I gave her a thumbs up. My wife gave her a thumbs down. And so it was kind of funny. But yeah, that was it. And then it was like, hey, it might be time to start packing this bag and see how heavy this thing is going to be. Like this is getting a little real now. So, you know, experiencing the 100 miles, yeah, I have that. I know what 100 feels like. But you know, this just being so far out of the element of the norm that it was wild. But yeah, a lot of emotions when we found out that I was going to be running it. It's just a different platform. And so, you know, it's almost like looking back to your first 100 when you have no idea what that experience feels like. And, you know, a lot of people do 50 mile, 100K before they jump into the 100 mile. But for you, everyone that's run 100 miles, you know, everyone will tell you, and it's the truth, that the race starts at mile 70. And so, you know, having that experience, I think, calmed me a little bit, but I was a little nervous, I'm not going to lie. And normally I don't get nervous on races, but just with this one being such an unknown, I was a little nervous.
Well, let's talk about the structure of this race.
Yeah, so the structure of the race is a little wild. It's I wouldn't say 100% self-supported because there are aid stations, but I would say it's 95 to 98% self-supported. you can have your crew at the start line, when you start, and then they're not going to see you again until you finish. So there's no crew, there are no pacers, no way for them to get on the course. When you are out there, you're out there by yourself, unless you partner up with someone. And that's typically from talking to other runners that have run, you know, races before in the winter ultra, that's a thing that typically happens, is you'll partner up with someone out there, you know, someone of equal speed and pace, and, you know, do the race together, help each other out. But yeah, the aid stations were, the first one was 17 miles long. The second one was 22 miles. The third one was 23. And then the last one was 19, and then 19 more to the finish line. So very spread apart. You know, yeah, that's a it's a mental drain for sure, going that long without aid. So you're required to carry everything that you need, you know, 23 miles in the middle of the night, that's going to take you a long time, right? And so you have to have all your food on you, all your water that you're going to be drinking. So it's just a platform that's set up to have be a self-supported style, you know, race pretty much.
So you headed to the start line. I found this odd. It started on Sunday. I've never seen a 100-miler start on Sunday.
Yeah. There's two reasons that it started on Sunday. So Saturday, you know, they gave everyone an opportunity to come in on Friday or Saturday, you know, that were out of state, out of town. And there's a mandatory brief that you have to attend. And you know, you hear about the mandatory briefs that some of these, you know, other races that you've done, 100 milers or, you know, 50 milers that, you know, they're optional or whatever. But like, I feel like this one was mandatory and there was reasons behind it. Some of the information they gave us was definitely need. And I was like, oh, you know, after I did that, I went back, heard the mandatory brief, and I went back and, you know, packed some different stuff because of what they had said. So, so the mandatory brief, and then the, BLM wants to get their money for the Saturday cabin. So we're not out there Saturday. So they get their money for the cabins on Saturday night. The cabins were where the aid stations were. And then we as in the racers and the race organization, paid for the cabins on Sunday and Monday. So it had a little bit to do with BLM and a little bit to do with like the brief. And so I've been told that that's kind of typical on these style races because the time frame is usually longer on a 100 miler. It's, you know, ours was a 40-hour cutoff. The other style races like Arrowhead and they have one down south called Susitna 100. It's 100-mile with a 48-hour cutoff. Arrowhead 135 is 135 miles, but it has a 60-hour cutoff. So your cutoffs are a little bit longer in these, just for the fact that you're thrown in the elements and you're going to be going slower. So anyway, I don't know where I went with that, but yeah. So they have to have these mandatory briefings. A lot of them have mandatory gear checks. And so that gives you an opportunity because if you didn't have some piece of gear that you needed, you have more of a chance to go get it. So,
yeah, I guess that makes sense. You know, government always wants their money, so of course. they're gonna push back anything else. Where, I mean, the race is paying for the cabins, but they probably make more money when there's multiple people using those cabins. So
if they can have, like, you know, just the locals that are going out on Saturday, we're using the cabins probably Friday and Saturday night. And then we were seeing them come out, you know, on Sunday when we were starting, everybody was snow machining out all their gear and equipment. So they got a full 4 days worth of money from us, you know, us racers. And then just the locals that are going out.
Well, take us to the starting line before the start of the race. What was the atmosphere like? What did you anticipate when you got there?
Yeah. So, you know, got to the starting line. It was kind of a weird, cause they have a parking lot that's on the other side of the road from the trailhead. And so everybody had to park on that area. And then we kind of hung out in there until like 10 minutes before the race start. And then we all walked across the road because there's just not enough parking across the road to get all the racers over there. So they did check in there and made sure that your little tracker was working because they track, you know, that you have your little blue dot that you can follow for, you know, 100 miles or whatever. And so the style of the race is bike, run, or ski. The majority of people being bikers, a few skiers. And then I don't know how many runners there actually were, but I think there was like maybe 15 runners out of 80 participants. So pretty low in runners. I think skiers probably were about the same, maybe 10, 15, and then the rest being bikers, lots and lots of bikers. So yeah, everyone's out there just kind of testing out their bikes, making sure everything's good to go. It's weird being at a start line where there's three different disciplines. So, you know, people have their massive ski poles and their skis in their hands for cross country skiing. And then then you see the runners with the massive backpacks and and then you know, of course, the bikers with their bikes loaded down with all the stuff that they'll need for their race. But yeah, it was kind of an odd starting line, because you know, there's the runner people and then there's the biker people, right? And like, we're kind of one and the same, but we're a little bit different. And so like, you know, everybody who's a biker knows each other, and everybody that's a runner somewhat knows each other. So it was a cool atmosphere from the fact that it wasn't just all runners. And so I thought that was neat. And so, you know, there's a couple like local dudes that were and gals that were out running, biking and or skiing that are like, you know, badasses. So like one of the guys that rode the bike had just won the ITI 1000. So 2 weeks prior, he had won a 1,000-mile race and he was out racing again at this one. And so it's like, you know, he's a local dude that's really awesome on a fat bike. I'm sure he's great on all the other bikes, but yeah, he just rode a 1,000-mile race, won it, and now he's out trying to take this one again. He ended up getting second. So, I mean, we got to fault him a little bit. and then there's a world-class skier that lives here. Do believe she owns the Arrowhead 135 ski record. So, you know, some of the runners that were here had previous records at different races. The lady that won it for the women's division, she broke the course record for this race. And she had previously ran the Susitna 100 and won that one. So, she won it out. She won Susitna 100 outright, and then got second place, first female at this one. So, some really good athletes. And you know, everybody's like, even at the race brief the night before, everybody's like, "Oh, they're so and so, blah blah blah." You know, so, it's just like you were. I'm not familiar with the winter ultras, and so I was kind of just like, I don't know who anybody is, right? And so, if you're a winter ultra runner, then you know all these people. I'm like, oh, you know, so and so's run this, this, and this, and it's like, I don't know. So, you know, but just wrapping it all back around, it was really cool to kind of see. I was parked right next to the guy that won the 1,000-mile, and so it was seeing him like jump out of his car like 5 minutes before we're going to walk across the road to get his bike ready, because he already knew it was ready, right? And so it's like, I don't know, just kind of the atmosphere and the nerves and everybody, you know, ready to go. Like we walk across the road, they played the national anthem, and then we were gone. And it was really weird, because it was like a real tight trail at the start, and you're funneling 80 people on this real tight trail, and there's the bikers, you know, somewhat go faster, so they're going up front, and then you have your fast skiers that are in the middle of your kind of your mid to backpack bikers, and then you have a few skiers, and then all the runners in the very back. So
it made me think, do you know how many, you know, like bikers and skiers and runners they let in? If there's 80 total, do you know the percentages?
They don't care. They let 80 people in. Whatever discipline you want to do, you can do. They let 80 people. So if all 80 of them sign up and they're all runners, they're all going to be running the race.
So I guess the majority were bikers.
Yeah, the majority were bikers. Yeah. But there's no, you sign up for the race. You don't really sign up as a biker or skier. Like they don't hold back like, oh, we have this many, you know, bikers, this many skiers that we have to get, this many runners. They don't do that. It's just, you just sign up for the race and then whatever, cause you can change your discipline up until the Friday before. You can change your discipline.
Oh, that's pretty cool. So if
yeah,
conditions are whatever, they can choose, yep, their discipline up to that day. That's cool.
Yeah. And I think that they had, there was somebody there was a really good runner, that I heard switched to skiing at the very end. So for whatever reason, I don't know, but decided to ski it. So, yeah.
So you guys and gals all take off. What was it like after, once you got going?
Yeah. So the, you know, it's like, you know, typically in a race where, you know, everybody's like Congo lined up at the beginning and then it kind of just spaces out over time. Like it didn't do that. It was super like quick, like right off the bat, like it was, they were gone. Everything spread out. Like probably the first quarter mile, everything was spread out because all the bikers took off, the skiers are gone. And then it's like us 10 or 12 runners that were together. A couple of the runners like really took off, but the rest of us runners like kind of hung back. And so we were together. Like I would say we were together for probably the first 60 miles, just within a couple miles of each other. But, yeah. And so everything kind of spread out and we were out there.
So what were the conditions like? What was the, I mean, I know there was snow, but was it hard packed? Could you run it?
Yeah. So at the very beginning of the race, you know, it was still pretty chilly. I think it might've been in the 20, high 20s, low 30s in the beginning. We knew that it was going to be getting hot, in the afternoons, going into the evening. And so the trail was pretty runnable at the very beginning, being that it was, you know, somewhat colder and the trail had kind of firmed up, but as the day went on, it got hotter and I think it got into the mid 40s and the trail just turned into, I was calling it sugar, running on sugar. Some people were calling it mashed potatoes, but yeah, it was kind of like running on sand for those that have run on like a beach or whatever. It was really hard to run on. You could run on it, but you were taking a step and your foot would slide, it would move, your foot would just kind of dip down into the snow. And so yeah, it was a little bit more difficult to run on when you had those type of conditions. But then there were spots that, you know, just were in the shade or whatever the reason that it was pretty firm and you could run. I would say the first 17 miles to that first aid station was pretty up and down. There was some pretty good sections where you could get going downhill. You know, but then it would turn right back into an up. It was pretty hilly on that first bit. And so, you know, obviously you don't want to go out the gate sprinting uphill. So, you know, take it easy on the uphills and kind of run the downs and the flats and, you know, but what you could run, because there were spots where you were post-holing through the snow. And so it really made it difficult for sure. And then on top of that, you're carrying a 21 pound pack. And so that's what I had, a 21 pound pack. And so, you know, I'm not a small guy by any means, 180, 190 pounds. And then adding a 21 pound pack to that, like, yeah, that was a you know, added measure of difficulty that you don't really consider, you know, having to carry all of your gear when, you know, your typical races are going to have a 4, maybe 5 pound pack, but then, you know, you run in this massive thing.
So take us to that first aid station, you know, how you felt, anything that was going on.
Yeah, I got to the first aid station. I felt great. I had no issues at all. My plan was to change socks at every aid station because I knew that the trail was going to be heating up and the snow was going to start to melt a little bit and get kind of that smashed potato sugary kind of feel to it. And so I decided to bring enough socks to change at every aid station. So yeah, got to the first aid station, refilled my water, refilled the hydration, the nutrition, you know, change socks and kind of away we were gone. We were there maybe 10 minutes. It was a pretty quick stop. So but yeah, that first aid station went quick, man. It was nothing serious. I know it seems like, you know, you're sitting at an aid station for 10 minutes and you're like, oh, wow, that's a long time. But when there's only one in 17 miles, when, you know, a normal race, you might have three in that period. So, yeah, 10 minutes to change socks, get some nutrition, and then, you know, head out on your way. And then, you know, and you got a big one coming up, you know, 22 miles. So wanted to make sure that everything was good to go.
What kind of food did they have at that aid station and how did they keep the water from freezing?
Yeah. So, they, you know, they had coolers, that wasn't really a concern at that aid station because they knew it was going to be hotter. And so, They had a hot water and a cold water. So if you wanted hot water, you had that option. There was nothing really like food wise at that aid station. It was more just like chips, cookies, candy type stuff. Not anything like food wise at that one. So, that one's just set up a very temporary aid station. It's kind of a little wall tent on the side of nothing. There's no cabin or anything. So they, yeah, that was just a real easy one for them to set up a couple tents. And then, I mean, it was only there. I think we got there. I think me and my buddy that we're running with at that time were almost the last ones in, and it took us like four and a half hours to get there. So it wasn't, that tent wasn't set up very long at all. So maybe they were set up 5 hours.
So get your stuff, change socks, headed out. What was it like for the next little section to the next aid station?
Yeah. So the next little aid station, Lexington section, more up and down, no really big climbs. That one was pretty interesting because a lot of us that were running together kind of split up. And so I would say split up, but we were within probably a mile or two of each other. So, I was going to run with this guy that I know up here, and he had to stop to adjust something. And he was like, yeah, just go ahead. I'll catch up to you. And then he never did. You know, I was feeling good. I was moving good. And so, yeah, I ran a lot and that by myself in that section. I probably, out of the 22 miles, I probably ran 15 to 17 miles by myself on that section, which was fine. You know, it was daylight. It was fine. I wasn't really concerned, at all with anything. The only concern that I had with the race was, not necessarily being by myself at night, but just kind of being by myself at night. Cause you know, it's like you're out in the middle of nowhere and, you know, but it really wasn't a concern at all. Like once I got on the course and I kind of saw what was going on. The cool thing about that section was, a spot called Beaver Creek. And so you climbed up a little bit, this climb, it wasn't a huge climb up, but a little bit of a climb, and then you drop down pretty far to the creek, and then you actually got on the creek and you probably ran for a half a mile, maybe a little bit further on the creek, but you know, it was fine. There was never a concern of falling through, even though that it had heated up, you know, that whole week had been in the 40s. But it was never a concern that the creek, an actual creek, was going to thaw out in a week. So, it was really, hard packed, and you know, the ice was great. And so there was no concern at all, but it was kind of neat because, you know, you never gone on a race where you cross creeks or you go creek crossings or whatever, but you never like walk down or run down the actual creek. So it was probably like a half mile of me running down the creek. So I thought that was really cool and kind of just something different that you don't typically get to experience. But, probably the last 2 miles, I met up with, a friend of mine that I'd only ever met on Instagram, lives down in Anchorage. Him and I both got selected for the Ultra Sign Up ambassador team this year. And so, you know, we thought that was kind of cool that, we had talked on Instagram about both of us racing, and then, saw him at the start line and, you know, here and there it seemed, but like actually, you know, spending some time with him. And, so yeah, we met up with about 2 miles to go to that last aid station. Him and I actually ended up running from that point all the way to the finish line, cause we were just moving together and, you know, same pace. And so, I thought that was really cool. To meet someone on Instagram and then actually, you know, get to, you spend 70 miles with someone, you really get to know them. So, yeah, I thought that was cool. So whether he, ever listens to, this podcast or not, you know, definitely want to thank Brandon because he helped me get through the race. And, you know, when I had my lows, he was in the high, and I, you know, probably the reverse. And so, I'm sure that I helped push him a little bit sometime too, but it was just a lot of fun to experience a race with someone that you don't know, you know, and so you kind of get to know that person. So it was a lot of fun. It really was. But yeah, we got to that next aid station. That one was in a cabin. So that was the first, one of the cabins. The rest were cabins as well. The interesting thing about that is when you go in these cabins, they have wood stoves that are burning, and then they have clotheslines that are above them. And so you take your socks off, you hang your socks, your hat, whatever you want that's wet, you hang it up above the stove as you're in the aid station, and it's, you know, it's drying it out. And so I already had socks that I was planning on changing into, so changed into fresh socks, but, you know, just took the other socks off and hung them up just in case you might have to use them again later, you know, if you get in an emergency. So backing up a little bit at the 17-mile aid station, and when I changed socks, I took those socks and I put them on the back of my pack on the outside so all the fresh air could let them, you know, kind of dry out, I guess. So anyway, I let those socks dry out and I put them in a bag, just in case. You never know what's going to happen later on. So we're at mile like 39, I think is what that aid station was. Yeah. Mile 39. So, they had baked potatoes. Ooh. I never had a baked potato I've had potatoes, but not like they were in the foil and everything. And then like, they had all of the fixings like bacon bits, butter, cheese, like you name it, sour cream. And it's like, I didn't know how my stomach was going to handle it because we knew ahead of time what each aid station was going to have. And I didn't realize, like, I was like, oh, I know a baked potato would be fine, but what about like sour cream and all this type stuff? Dude, I'm not going to lie. I just loaded that thing with everything and it was so good. And just, you know, about mile 40, you're starting to get a little in the dumps a little bit. You know, it's like, okay, the race is still, you know, the race is going now.
Yeah.
You're 40 miles deep. And, dude, that potato just like, it hit so hard. It was good. Like tons of energy leaving that place. I was just like, that was it. You know, a lot of people had gotten to that aid station around the same time as us. There was probably 10 or 12 of us that were there at the same time. So it was cool just seeing and matching everybody's energy. Like everybody, you know, there's a couple people there on the lows that were like, maybe I'm, you know, not take a nap, but just sit up here and rest for a little bit. And like, some people are like raring to go. Let's get this thing running, you know? And so, another guy that we were kind of following was on a split board, you know, well, not skis, but on a split board, like skinned out split board. So like he was moving at runner pace, which was fine. You know, he was cool. He was chilling, but, it was kind of neat to see him on a split board. I was like, man, bravo to you. And so, yeah, we kept kind of running into him a little bit too. But yeah, leaving that aid station after those baked potatoes, yeah, that was good. That was really good. Lots of energy leaving that one.
I bet. Just hearing you describe that makes me want to have a baked potato.
I know, right? I'm wanting one now.
When I finished Scout Mountain, their finisher food was baked potatoes because it was in Idaho. And
yeah,
they had all the stuff. But, you know, after 100 miles, sometimes you just didn't want to eat. I'm like, baked potato does not sound good. But one sounds delicious now. I could only imagine a nice warm baked potato at mile 40.
Yeah, because they had put them on, you know, they baked them however they did it. And then they had them on that stove, the wood stove. And so they were really hot and it wasn't cold out. It was fine. I mean, actually, one guy came in and had his shirt completely off. He was running without a shirt on. Like, it was cold enough for me to keep my shirt on, but it was in the 40s. And so, but yeah, so it was just kind of funny. Like the way the temperatures changed throughout the race was really comical. But
what time was it? Do you remember what time it was when you got into there?
It was, man, I had time hacks that I wanted to hit and I can't remember what that time hack was. It was 8 hours. So do the math on that. What is that? Yeah, I don't know. It was was it 8 hours? No, it was 10 hours. So it must've been 6 o'clock, okay. O'clock in the evening. Yeah. So I wanted to. My goal was to hit all of the aid stations. I wanted to be at mile 60 at sub 30 pace. That was my goal. And so, yeah, that was my goal, was to be at mile 60 at sub 30 hour pace.
Okay.
And so, so I was still moving at sub 30 pace, up until that point. So, yeah. It was about 6 o'clock at night. So I think we stayed at that aid station for about an hour, just getting 45 to an hour. I can't remember the exact time. You know, just changing socks, chilling a little bit. You know, we had just done 22 miles. It's really hard. You know, I'm sure when people are listening to this, like, oh my God, you said an hour for an aid station, but like, and I'm sure that's a long time for a lot of people, but it's just so mentally draining to me. It was being out there for 22 miles with nothing, right? Mm-hmm. And especially since if you're used to that, that may not have been a big deal, but I wasn't used to it. And so it was so draining mentally that once you're there and you're seeing people and you're talking to people, you're like, oh my gosh, yeah, this is so nice again, right? And so, you know, that you had to top up your mental status as well. And so it's like, yeah, I have no regrets at all about sitting there for an hour. None at all. I enjoyed every minute of it. And the baked potatoes were amazing.
Yeah. You know, when these aid stations are 20 plus miles apart, you know, that's depending on time, 6 to 8 hours, you know, how fast you're traveling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without seeing or having any creature comforts of warmth, drying your clothes, warm food, any of that stuff. I totally get it. I would have done the same thing. Cause like you're saying, you have to prepare to go out and do that next segment, which could be, who knows, right? You got to go, you're starting to go into the night. You want to make sure you're freaking ready to get that next one in.
And the next section was the hardest section. That was 23 miles through the night with the biggest climb. And so, you definitely wanted to be ready for that. Definitely.
So when you left that aid station, did you leave with anyone or did you go out by yourself?
Yeah. Left with the same guy, Brandon, left with him. And then there was a couple other people that were kind of just like right around us. We could see, a couple up ahead of us. And I think there was like one or two that were behind us. We ended up catching the two in front of us. You know, passing them. One of the guys actually rolled his ankle, and so it was pretty bad, and so that ended his race. But he was moving extremely well, and you know, had really good spirits up until the point where he rolled his ankle. But and he even still had really good spirits because we saw him at the next aid station. Still had really good spirits about it, you know. But you know, that happens. That's ultra, right? And so ended up catching those guys. Didn't see him after that. Until we got to the next aid station. But man, the next one was my favorite section. It was long and it was draining again, right? But wow, what a section. I'm getting chill bumps just thinking about how cool it was. So had about a 6 mile, probably just up and down, running, I think along a creek bed, just, you know, your typical hills that you'll run in an ultra, nothing major. And then we come up to this pass where there's two mountains on either side of us, right? And you're going through the pass up and over it. And so it's probably a 4 or 5 mile climb to get to the top of the pass. But as we're doing that, so, you know, it's like, I think at the top of the pass, we were there at like 1 o'clock in the morning or something like that. But the moon had come out and it was clear skies. It was a full moon. It was the actual full moon night. So the moon was super bright, right? And then the aurora came out after that. And so it was just like, dude, could not have asked for a better night to run that race. It got chilly, but it wasn't that bad. You know, I've been told at the top of the divide that the wind's going to be really bad. The wind was not blowing at all. Yeah, it was colder because we climbed an elevation and obviously it got night. So it was probably in the teens, maybe lower. I don't know, but dude, it was so cool. Just like the moon lighting up the mountains like it was in the day, you know, the aurora popping out over the mountains and then dancing all over the top of us. Like there's not another race out there that's going to compare to that when, you know, climbing that divide. It's like I snapped a shot of the mountains with the aurora behind it. And it's just like there was no other place in my mind that I could have been at that time. And, you know, had just like been there, you know, like I was there in that time. And so I don't know, it's just like, it's hard to explain, but it was just so cool. Something really cool about where we were at that time. And they had told us this at the pre-race brief, that the furthest point from a road in the lower 48 or the continental United States is 21 miles. And that's in Yellowstone National Park. So you can go out in the middle of nowhere in Yellowstone National Park, and the nearest point is 21 miles, or the furthest point is 21 miles from a road. When I took that picture on top of that pass, the furthest point from a road was 23 miles.
Oh, wow.
And so, like, that's how remote this race was. It was out there. And so, yeah, so it's just like, you are out there, right? You're like, it's, man, it's just so hard to explain how freaking cool it was. Like, you know, I've done a lot of races where I've gone through the night and gone up to high mountain passes, but nothing was like that. Man, someone was looking down on me that night saying, "Hey, look what I can do." Just like, so cool, man. Like with the stars and the moon and the aurora coming out, the mountains, like it was just peaceful and it was quiet. It was just like, I was in awe, man. I was in awe. It was such a beautiful, pretty night.
I bet that sounds amazing. Did you find some energy from that?
I did. Well, what the energy was is they, after you get off the pass, you have to go down, right? So, so probably, I don't know what the distance is, but you pretty much run all the way downhill until you get to the next cabin, the next aid station. And so like a real long descent into that aid station. I don't know what the distance was, but, you know, I'd say like probably a 5 or 6 mile downhill and then probably some flat going into that. But we ran down, there's this place called the Ice Lakes. So that's, you run downhill, you do a couple turns and then you're on the ice lake. So it's not really a lake. It's just kind of like where all the water just kind of runs down off the mountains and collects and freezes. Right. And so it becomes the ice lakes or whatever. We didn't even realize we were on it until we started hearing like this. Our footsteps sound different. It's like, I think we're on the ice lakes, and you'd look around and you'd see like big old clumps of ice that were just kind of sitting out there like, oh, that's not a rock. That's a piece of ice. But yeah. And normally they say the ice lakes can be pretty bad with, you know, overflow, which is water that, you know, seeps out over top of the ice and then, you know, would refreeze through the night and then would have liquid throughout the day. And so I didn't have much of that at that point and hadn't really run into any overflow. Past the ice lakes, though, that's when we started really hitting the overflow, and we hit lots of it. I bet there was 30 to 40 spots of overflow.
Wow.
Going into that next aid station at mile 62, my partner was trying to go around some overflow, and he fell through the ice probably past his ankles. And so feet were wet, you know, pants were starting to freeze, your shoe freezes. And so, yeah, he was getting cold and was kind of concerned because I think we were still 3 or 4 miles out from that aid station when he did it. And so, he was like, "Hey man, I need to run more cause I need to cool, you know, warm my body up a little bit." Cause, a lot of that race for us was hiking. A lot of it was, you know, a fast paced hike. And so we ran where we could, but yeah, it was one of those spots where like, "Hey, we need to really kind of move to get there faster so he can, you know, get what he needs to get done to make it to the finish line." And then, yeah, basically that's what, yeah. But yeah, so that was definitely a concern. I think around that point, somewhere down in that low lying area, my stomach started to flip a little bit. Which is kind of a normal thing to happen in an ultra marathon. But, I had been using the cluster dextrin, and instead of Element, I was using Scratch with it. And I think the amount of sugar that Scratch has in it, it started messing with my stomach. Cause I don't normally do that much sugar. I normally don't do hardly any sugar at all just because sugar affects me pretty bad. But I thought, okay, Scratch is, you know, it's not that bad. You know, there's more, you know, sodium and stuff in Scratch than there are sugar. But I just think that little amount of sugar in Scratch just really kind of, you know, like laid it on thick. And so, yeah, stomach was starting to turn in that one. I actually think I was going to get sick at that next aid station because it was really cold. We were at kind of the bottom, in a bottom, right? Right next to a creek. I don't know what the actual temperature was, but I think it was below zero there. It was cold. And another thing that we were kind of experiencing, the heat throughout the day, you know, had melted some of the snow and just, it was just really wet. And so like that night, it was just a real humid wet. And yeah, so, you know, when you have a humid cold, that's colder, you know, it's always a dry heat. Well, you know, there's a dry heat and a wet heat for sure. But,
yeah.
that wet cold is really cold. And so got to that next aid station, finally. I say finally, cause it was another drain, but, I think we got there around 2:15 in the morning is when we got to the aid station, 2:15, 2:30, somewhere around in there. It was just, there was one gal in there serving us soup with meatballs. I had one bite of the meatball and I decided that my stomach was not having that. Yeah, everybody was, the same people that we kind of been leapfrogging back and forth with. We're definitely still at that aid station. So, once again, kind of the same setup, had the stove with the clothesline, hanging up socks, changing socks, getting food, getting prepared, taking a break a little bit, getting ready to go for the next section. It was a good aid station. It was fun. The person that was working the aid station took our pictures when we left. And so I'm interested to see like where do our pictures end up and like what we looked like. But she took each individual person's picture when they left the aid station. So I thought that was kind of interesting. That's cool. And funny.
How long do you think you spent at that aid station?
An hour. Yeah, an hour. For sure. An hour, 45 to an hour for sure. Yeah. All of them were 45 to an hour after that first one.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Like I said, no shame. If I did it again, I would do it again another hour. I wouldn't change a thing, man, to be honest with you.
So when you left there, was your stomach still?
It was. And I kind of thought like, so I don't know if I talked about it, but I carried two 40 ounce double walled insulated bottles, instead of using a bladder or, a pack or, whatever the bottles are up front. I didn't carry those. I carried two insulated bottles. Looking back, I think I would have carried a bladder. It would have been lighter because those bottles were heavy. But in saying that, I didn't have a bladder or anything like that. So those two bottles both had nutrition and scratch in them. And I think that is what was getting me, like I discussed earlier. But I didn't change anything at that aid station like I should have. Mm. I think I should have swapped to just at that point, 40 miles to go, 38 miles to go in the race. I think I should have just like abandoned that right then and just went straight to water. And I didn't do that. I still poured all that clusterdextrin. It wasn't the clusterdextrin. It was 100% the sugar in the scratch. But I should have abandoned it at that point and just went straight to water and just let my stomach calm a little bit from all that sugar. And I was still using scratch. I was just using Spring Energy as as a backup. And so I had plenty of Spring Energies left to get me through the race, but I should have just like kind of let my stomach calm a little bit, kind of took it a little bit lighter on the nutrition while I was, going through the night. Going through the night, you're going to be moving a little bit slower and maybe don't need as much nutrition as you would during the day when you're moving a little bit better and a little bit quicker. But I continued to drink that stuff and it still was messing with me. And it just like, at one point I was like, all right, I'm going to keep it on me. If I need a drink, I'll grab a drink, but I'm going to try to make it, to a med tent. So in between the second and third aid station, the third and the fourth aid station and the fourth aid station to the finish, they had a med tent. And so all that was in the med tent was one medic with some water. So it wasn't anything. And it was literally a tent that they were, well, when we got to them, most of the time they were asleep. So it wasn't any, they didn't have any food or anything. And it was more just like, hey, are you guys okay? Yeah, we're good. We're going to keep, obviously keep going basically. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, it's not an aid station by any means. It's literally a medic in a tent. it's not harder to describe than that. So they're sleeping on a cot pretty much, with a little stove in there to keep them warm. But, and so I was like, okay, I got about 10 miles until I get to that med tent and I can replenish my water with like actual water. So if I need to take a drink of something, I'll just take a sip of this. That way my stomach's not bothering me too much. And I was able to get to that spot without really having to rely on that water. Because I'd been hydrating so well throughout the day. I was like, I know I'm well hydrated. I can make it 10 miles to that next med tent and then dump all this stuff out and get pure water. And then once I kind of stopped drinking that mixture and got to that med tent and got water and started flushing my system of all that sugar, I started to feel way better. Yeah, that helped a lot. The next section was, you know, that's where a lot of that overflow, like as soon as we left the aid station at mile 62, there was about an overflow section of about probably 400 or 500 yards long. It was huge. And so it's like, it's all ice, right? It's huge chunks of ice. The whole thing is a piece of ice, right? But you would take a step and your foot would kind of somewhat fall through and you'd pull back real quick. And then you'd be like, okay, I can't step there. Let me try to step over here. And then, so you're just like trying to find where the ice is strong enough that you can step on. So I actually had my foot fall through there, only one of them, but I had one foot fall through and I was like, dang it. And so, so that's starting to get cold, obviously, because you have a foot that's soaking wet now. I was wearing merino wool socks. So like, you know, the heat was staying in on my foot. It was fine. But yeah, I had to go real slow through that section and, you know, find our way. And as soon as we got on the other side of it, I sat down and I changed just that one sock from one of those socks that had been air drying out for the entire day. You know, I changed into one of those. And so, that made it feel way better. And was able to press on, but, I don't remember much about that section. I just remember it being super freaking long and lots of overflow. It was just, you know, coming through the night. One thing that I do remember was we had been caffeinating great, right? You know, I had caffeine pills I was taking. I started caffeinating at, the second aid station. You know, I started having caffeine and doing caffeine pills. And then, you know, taking them sporadically in between the aid stations. And then when I got to the next aid station, taking another one. And but man, at about 30 minutes before sunrise, me and the running partner, Brandon, was like, he would kind of go off the trail a little bit and I'd grab him. And I was behind him, so he couldn't grab me. But I remember like catching myself going off the trail. And like, if you go off the trail, like you're going hip deep, the snow is just that deep on either side of the trail. So you had to be careful. But yeah, it was like, two drunk guys stumbling around at 3 o'clock in the morning, but we're just super tired. And so, it was definitely pretty funny, but I'd catch him and I'd laugh like, dude, you all right? And he's like, yeah, I'm good. I'm just tired. And like, Yeah, me too. And then like 2 seconds later, I'd be falling down. I'm like, what is going on here?
A little sleepwalking.
Actually. Yeah, it definitely was. For about 30, 45 minutes, we were both definitely sleepwalking. I was like, man, I'm ready for that sun to come up to wake me up a little bit. But that's a horrible feeling. But I guess you could have taken a nap on the side of a trail. But it was like, when you're taking a nap on the side of the trail there, like it's snow. It's going to be cold. So yeah. It's like, I don't want to do this. So.
Snow nap.
So it was a lot different, but yeah, I don't remember much about that section other than it being, it was a long one, right? I mean, they all were, it was 19 miles long and lots of overflow, but I would say it was pretty flat. A lot of little hills, nothing that I remember being like really extreme, to be honest with you.
So you got into the next aid station. What mile was that? 80-ish?
The next aid station, mile, I believe 82, 83. I can't remember. It was weird because my watch was different than his watch. The course was a little short. I think it ended up being 97. So it was kind of hard to judge like what everything was going to be, but it was 82, 83, somewhere in there. But yeah, so that aid station was the ramen station. They had ramen. It was run by a family. They had got in there by dog sled. So they dog sledded into the aid station, which I thought that was cool. So when you were coming up to the aid station, you could hear the dogs just going crazy being outside, right? But yeah, it was cool little spot. Same setup as all the other ones. Like it was a bigger cabin, so it could accommodate more people. But yeah, ran in kind of the same people, sat down, had some ramen, you know, dried my socks, knowing that leaving that spot, you're headed home, right?
Yeah.
You got between 17 and 19 miles until you're there. So, yeah, it was a cool little station, 45 an hour, just like all the other ones. And then, rocking and rolling on the way out. This next section was really cool though, because excuse me. I'll have to remember to edit that one out. this next section was really cool though, because it was, well, I didn't say it was cool, but it was kind of another, like, you only see this stuff in Alaska type deal. We come up to another overflow spot, but it's like a creek that's flowing. And so it's like, what do we do? So they had told us at the pre-race meeting to bring trash bags if you're walking, so you can put them over your legs and go across the water. And so there was no way around this area. So we're like, I guess we're just going to do trash bags and then get over it, you know? And so we put trash bags. Each one of us stepped into two trash bags and walked across this river. I mean, it wasn't really a river. It was like, it was ice layer on the bottom, and you're probably shin deep, you know, walking through just the top layer of water. But it was kind of funny. If you look on my Instagram, there's a reel about it.
Makeshift waders.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. It was, the light waders. I guess there are waders out there that you can buy that are made for like packing and stuff like that. But yeah, it definitely didn't have any. So trash bags it was, but
that's a good idea to keep in the back. Cause
yeah,
you know, there's all those creek crossings, river crossings sometimes.
Yep.
That might be good just in a normal race.
Couple trash bags, legs and feet. Well, I mean, if you got your feet wet, like you could have changed socks, but like it's cold out. Right. And so you're still at risk for, you know, all kinds of issues if you get your feet wet. But yeah, it was, you know, across that river, and then we had a massive climb, a pretty big one. I wouldn't say anything was really massive. They were just long. And so this long climb, and then they have this thing at the very end of the race called the wall. And so you've got to climb up the wall. We're 13 miles out from the wall and you can see it. And you're just like, holy crap, that's a long ways away. We got to go all the way over there. And so that's kind of disheartening at the same time. You're like, dang it, I got to go that far. That's insane. But yeah, so you can see it about 13 miles out. And then you kind of drop down in this valley and you're just kind of, you know, flowing through this valley and until you get to the wall. You know, nothing to really report on that. We're just kind of running flats and ups and downs, and another water crossing where you had to put the trash bags back on, but that was pretty close to the wall area. But yeah, tons of overflow, and that's the heat started to come out again, the mid-40s, and so starting to get back into that mashed potato running, and it was crazy. Got to the wall. It was about, I think it was 600 feet up at about an eighth of a mile. So pretty good little climb. Yeah. Especially at about, I think this was about 90-ish miles, mile 90. And so, yeah, you got 90 miles in your legs and they want you to climb a 600-foot deal. And so, yeah, got up it surprisingly pretty easily. You know, I had my poles the whole time, so it wasn't an issue getting up it. But yeah, then so the whole race course was a lollipop, right? And so you had a little stem and then a big loop and then back to the stem. And so once you got to the top of the wall, you're back on the stem part of the lollipop, so which was 6 miles. So
just back to the finish was 6 miles.
Yep. Back to the stem, 6 miles. And that was kind of the victory lap at that point. You know, you're back to familiar territory that you've already done before. So, they had this thing where at a mile out from every aid station, they had a sign saying, hey, you're a mile out. So, you know, we're just like, where's that sign? Because you can see, it started at Wickersham Dome. And so you could see Wickersham Dome from quite a ways out. And so you knew where the finish line was. You're just like, man, I got to get over there. Once you got to the top of the wall in that 6 mile section, you could, but, and so, you know, we finally found that 1 mile section. It's 1 mile all the way downhill. And, I'd like to say that we sprinted, but, looking back on the time, it was about a 14 minute mile.
That ain't bad, man.
You know, mile 96, I threw down a 14 minute mile. So I'm pretty happy with that. And then, you know, came across the finish line, 97 miles. A lot of my friends were there. My wife, race director. As soon as I finished, like I said, me and the race director are pretty good friends. And so, she handed me a bottle of Fireball right off the bat and we took a shot of Fireball. I don't mind Fireball and I like Fireball, but there was something about 97 miles on my stomach and my throat and my body just like immediately taking a shot of Fireball. It was pretty funny. So, but yeah, it was great. I enjoyed it. I did.
Would you do it again?
Probably not. there's two reasons. I don't like to repeat races. I want to go see something different. And B, it was mentally draining. It really was. You know, I just kept telling my buddy that we were running with. I was like, man, I don't think this is for me, man. I really don't think this is for me. But you know how it is when you finish a race, you never remember the bad times, right? You always remember the good stuff. And so, I'll never say never that I'll do it again. But I'm pretty confident that I will never do it on foot again. So, I do think next year I will do it, but I'll do it on a bike. I think a bike will be cool. Yeah. And so, yeah, doing it on foot, probably not, but, I'm never going to say never to another winter ultra because there are multiple ones up here and it would be cool to go see something new and do something different. There's others up here that you're required to carry so much gear that you have to have a sled. And so I think pulling a sled for 100 miles would be something different as well. So, I'm never going to say never, but probably not.
That was going to be my next question. Another winter ultra, but you already answered that. So
maybe. There's another 100 down here that I talked about a little bit. So Sitna 100, it's about 5 hours south of here. So the weather conditions are a little bit, could not be as cold because, the White Mountain 100 could be, all the way down to -40. Where the Susitna is probably not going to get that cold, but they're going to get more moisture. They're going to get more snow. And so you could have a really snowy year, which makes things difficult as well. So, I might do that one. I don't know. I haven't decided yet. I've run two seasons of races in Alaska, not necessarily a winter race, but just training through the winter. This next winter, I think I want to just chill. I want to go out and do group runs and run when I want and, you know, just chill. I don't really want to run a winter ultra, whether it be in Alaska or, in the States. I don't really want to train through the winter again. So not that I didn't mind it. And like I said, not that I won't, go out and run when it's -30 out because that's not fun, but it's fun. It's just like, I just don't want to have to, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I think I've already decided that last year I was like, I'm not running another winter ultra. And then I signed up for another winter ultra. So, but, I think I will, I think I'll just chill and, you know, have some fun next year, but I might bike the White Mountains 100. I think it'd be really fun to, you know, ride 20 miles and chill at an aid station for an hour and ride 20 miles. And so
what did the bikers finish in? Do you know?
The winning biker did it in, I think, 9-something.
Holy God.
Yeah, it's fast. My buddy who is a runner who also bikes and skis, but, I would say he's primarily a runner. He biked it, and he did it in like 16 hours. Okay. So, I would say somewhere probably average was probably 12 to 16. That was probably average somewhere in that range. Fast. Yeah.
Yeah. That's fast.
I don't even know what the skiers, I think the winning skier did it like 13 or something like that. I mean, the winning runner did it in 20. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So you ran the whole thing.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Course record was broken by the women's course record was broken. So, yeah.
So I always have to ask after you do these adventures, what'd you learn about yourself?
I learned that I can push further than what I thought possible. And what I mean by that is not in the physical stance, but more mental stance. I am a very extroverted runner. I enjoy running in groups. I don't mind running by myself. I don't like to run by myself. I'd prefer to run in a group, which is different than a lot of people. And so knowing going in that there was a possibility that I was going to be running by myself, at night throughout the day, there's tons of wildlife out here that can definitely kill you. I didn't see anything. Some of the guys, the snow machiners that were the medics, were saying that they saw wolves. I never saw anything. I saw tracks, but I just thought they were dogs. Could have been wolves. Who knew? But I didn't see anything. But knowing that there was that possibility, like there's animals out there that could potentially kill you, right? The elements can get where you're going to be freezing cold. You could be hypothermic. You could get frostbite running by yourself. You know, it's like how far to the next aid station, how far to that next med tent, you know, not knowing all these things. If like I have a problem, I'm 5 to 10 miles out from somewhere, like that problem could be catastrophic by the time you get to that 5 to 10 miles. So having all of that kind of in the back of your mind, you know, really. And then, like I said, not having your crew or anything at those aid stations was kind of a mental drain. And so knowing that I can push further than what I thought possible mentally was kind of cool to see.
Yeah, I like that. That there was a lot of factors in this race.
There was.
That you could not control.
Tons.
You know, a lot of these longer races, there's a lot of stuff in control set up by the race organization. You know, multiple people being out on the course with you. You know, you could have been alone, like you were saying, the whole 97 miles.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could imagine how mentally draining that was, just let alone knowing 3 days before that you got into the race. Then like, oh shit, I'm in. Now I got to do all this shit.
Yep.
And before you knew it, it was time to go and prepared or not.
Yeah. Yeah. You gotta exactly. Go. Exactly. You know, I've always, you know, since we started doing all of this, like there's always been talk of the 200, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that this race gave me tons of confidence in knowing that I can do a 200. In saying that, you know, your aid stations are 20 miles apart-ish somewhat in a 200, but you're usually going to have a crew at those next aid stations. You're usually going to be picking up a pacer. And so you have that to look forward to. There was never that at this aid station, right? I knew that I was not going to see my crew until I hit the finish line.
Yeah.
So I had to do 100 miles before I was going to see my crew. And so, yeah, I had people that were out there that I was running with. Yeah, you know, there is that, but knowing that you don't have a crew, you don't have pacers to pick up, you know, you don't have that at all. Like it was tough. And so I it gave me so much confidence to know that I can do a 200, and I can't wait to start one.
Nice. Well, we didn't talk really about, you know, much of your gear. You kind of highlighted on a little bit, but you know, let's hear about your gear.
Yeah. So, everything was carried in a Yusui Hijacker 30 liter pack. It was a great pack. It does not move on you. I like the Yusui. I've never, I used the Yusui a little bit when I was out training, never loaded down, but just, I would use it here and there. It does make this little squeaky noise that just drove me insane, but I think it's just plastic on plastic squeaking. But yeah, it was great pack. Like I said, on the outside, it had two pockets on the hip. So it had a hip belt as well as a, you know, a chest and then a hip. Cause it is a fast packing pack. Oh my gosh, that's hard to say. And so I kept like my phone in one pocket and my nutrition in the other, my Spring Energy. I have to have some sort of mint, or like I use cough drops this time, but sometimes most of the time I use mints because my throat gets dry and that's the only thing that can really like help it out. And so, I kept those and then like my Spring Energies and gummies or whatever else I had on me, in that other side pocket. I had two, 40 ounce, I don't know what the brand of them are, but two 40 ounce double walled insulated bottles that I carried my water and nutrition in. Inside the pack, I had I had some Thermaline pants that I did not use until the finish line, but at the finish line, I put them on, Thermaline pants. I had three pair of socks to change into at all the aid stations. I had a couple hats that I wore, I was happy with because at one of the aid stations, a jug got knocked over and one of my hats got wet. And so I was like, oh, think I brought an extra. I brought three pair of gloves. I brought some real heavy duty gloves for the night. I brought some like medium weights. And then I brought some real light gloves for like during the day when it was, you know, in the 40s. Like I have Raynaud's, and so I have to have some kind of coverage over my hands, even if it's 40 degrees. So I had those really light gloves that I wore for that. I brought an extra shirt. I never changed it. I wore the same shirt the whole time. So, you know, looking back, I could have shed that 3 ounces. let's see what else. I had all my nutrition. So each aid station, I had a bag of cluster dextrin and scratch along with Spring Energies that I was going to be using, or gummies, beef jerky, that type of stuff that I was changing out. So my pack got a little lighter as it went on, but not much. Of course, the two trash bags, a couple other things that I can't think of. Oh, all of my electronic stuff, like my headlamp, my waist lamp. I use the Phoenix DT640, I believe is what it is. That is a phenomenal headlamp. I got it right before when I got back from Korea. It was sitting on my doorstep, and man, I used it a little bit just to test it out, but I wore it for the race, and it's got a white light and a yellow light. And so, but you're talking about lighting up the trail, that white light, holy crap, it has three different settings. That thing was money. So the whole time I've been training out of here, I ran a waist lamp and a headlamp. I took my waist lamp off. I was like, I don't need my waist lamp. I got this, oh, wow. It was so bright. I was very, very impressed with it. So, and it's purple, so that's kind of cool. But a phenomenal headlamp. Really, really great. I may be calling the 640 ROM, but it's the DT something by Phoenix Sports. Like, phenomenal headlamp. I'm sold on it for sure. And then so like if you're like needing a low light, you turn on the yellow light. And if you need something bright, you turn on the white light. And it's like, it was great. So yeah, I had been running dual lights the entire winter, and that was the first time where I was like, I feel comfortable enough just to run with one light. So, the reason I ran with two lights was the fact that, you know, moose or whatever on the trail, you want to be able to see them pretty far off, but, I didn't need two with that headlamp. That thing was money.
Spotlight.
It was, dude. Honestly, it's a spotlight. It's pretty incredible how great it is, but. And so I had a battery charger just in case one of my like headlamp or anything went down, or recharge the phone for some reason if I needed it, some headphones, you know, your typical stuff that you carry. But that's pretty much it, unless I'm forgetting anything. I didn't bring an extra pair of shoes or anything.
You haven't talked about your shoes.
Oh yeah. I ran in the, Caldera sevens, the Brooks Caldera sevens. Those made it through the entire race. I wore some Brooks tights, just like your typical tights, not insulated tights. And then I threw, like, when it got kind of cold, I threw just like their Brooks wind pants. They're their High Point wind pants. That's all they're just wind protection. That's all they are. They're real light, non-breathable. So keep a little bit of heat in. And those work, that combo worked the whole time. I didn't need to put on my thermal pants at all. My legs don't ever really get really cold. It's more my top that gets cold. So I wasn't too concerned about my legs, but yeah, just with those regular leggings, and then the wind pants, that combo worked really well. For my top, I wore a, merino wool shirt by Kraft. And then I wore a wind protector, wind type jacket, on top of the merino wool. And then in the night when it got really cold, I put a puffy on top of all of that. So, yeah, it did get cold. Like I say, it was that moist cold. So I know everybody's gonna love that word moist that we're saying 100 times, but
moist.
But yeah, so I put that the puffy on top of those, and so that was plenty. And then I had my real thick gloves on at night and stuff like that. So, but yeah, that was the gear, and then just random hats. You know, nothing particular on hats. One of them was just like the Brooks pom-pom beanie hat and then the other one was like a smart wool just hat, like a real light one for the daytime.
What poles did you use?
I used the Black Diamonds. I have a set of Leckie poles that I just got, but I didn't know how the Leckie, you know, the Leckie comes with those gloves that you put on that you link into the poles. I didn't know how those were going to work with gloves already on, so I chose to use my Black Diamond poles. That you can slip your hands through the little wrist deals instead of wearing the gloves, which I think worked out. I there was a couple people out there that had the Leckie poles on, not being as familiar with the Leckies with the gloves, I thought it better just to run with the Black Diamonds. And so the Black Diamonds worked perfect. I actually think that they broke, honestly. I think they did. I think they got too cold. They were starting to wobble and starting to creak a little bit. I think my running partner was getting really mad because every time I'd bury my poles, they would be like, but I took them apart when I finished the race, and I haven't really messed with them since. So I need to go out there and like kind of look and see what kind of damage I did to them. But I saw some stuff like leaking out of them and then freezing to the poles. So they have like some kind of oil or something on them that I need to go. But luckily I got some Leckie, so yeah, I don't need them anymore. Yeah. But yeah. So perfect time for them to break if they were going to break, but it got me through a couple hundreds already. So it's kind of sad if they have to go, kind of sad to see them go, but yeah. I think that's it as far as gear. I did wear some Gooder sunglasses that were snow glasses. So, it took the reflection off of the snow. And those things worked phenomenal. So I didn't know that they were winter glasses. I just grabbed them cause I thought they looked cool cause they're white with pink lenses. And, my wife told me right before I left and she was like, yeah, those are the winter edition. And I was like, oh, perfect. So, and yeah, they worked great. As you know, you could have just wore regular sunglasses, but, you know, having them where I could see a little bit better and not have the reflection off the snow, it worked out perfect.
Yeah. I used, when we did the Nightcrawler, I used those, the Gooders with the clear lenses.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember super
sensitive. And,
I remember that. Yeah.
Those things were awesome just to have something covering my eyes through the night.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So, before we go, how's the recovery going? How much have you eaten?
You know, it's going really well. here's the weird thing. Normally when I do 100, I'm not hungry for a couple days afterwards. Man, as soon as I finish that race, I scarf down like 2 hot dogs, like one, like almost a big bag of chips. Like I was hungry, ate the next day, just fine. You've been eating fine. The same thing with not running for about a week afterwards. I don't really watch what I eat for the week afterwards either. Just like, in my opinion, my body needs fuel. And so, you know, I don't go out and just go eat cake and ice cream and all that type stuff. You know, I feed my body what it needs, but I don't really pay attention to it. Right. And so like if I'm eating extra, I don't care. Cause you know, you burned a lot, your body broke down a lot. And so, I don't really pay attention to that for a week or so afterwards. Recovery's going really well. I had a little issue on the top of my foot. So I have a really high arch, and when my foot starts to swell, it pushes into the top of my shoe. It happens on all my races, but typically I have an extra pair of shoes that I can change into to kind of eliminate that issue. But this time running in the same pair of shoes the whole time, I had to deal with the issue for the entire 100 miles, but, so I can still feel it on the top of my foot. And then I had a little bit of an Achilles deal that popped up on that last 20 miles. And so I'm still kind of feeling it, it's nothing of concern. It's just sore, basically, you ran 100 miles. And so
right.
Your body's just sore, but, legs, knees, yeah, as you would have it, my knees don't hurt. So,
what do you mean?
It's funny, right? We take our dog to these puppy classes. And so I was at the puppy class with her on Thursday, and there's a lot of stuff where you have to like bend down and then kind of rotate, And so I was noticing my hips were hurting a lot. I was like, ooh, I need to go sit down. My hips are kind of, need to be loosened up a little bit. So, never really had like hip pain and, didn't feel anything out on the course, but could tell that I was still just a little sore and maybe take it a little bit easy, but. Yeah, recovery's going great. I haven't ran a mile since the race, and probably won't until after this podcast comes out. And so, but yeah, awesome.
Well, congrats on another hundo.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
It was awesome. It was awesome to follow.
Yeah, follow my blue dot.
Yeah, it was quite interesting because, I couldn't figure out. Like you click on something and it says foot or whatever, right? It just had all these things and like different colors. Then finally I found the legend to tell you what the different colors were. Then I was like, oh, okay. Then I was getting a little frustrated because I would always, I just left it on my phone. Then, I'd do the little heart thing on leaderboard, but every time I'd come back, I couldn't find you. So I'd have to find you all over again. So.
Yeah. The tracking, I'm very surprised they had tracking for as remote as we were. I'm surprised that there was tracking available. But from what I was told, it worked pretty well. There was a couple spots where it kind of glitched, but from what I was told, it worked pretty well. So
no, it was really super easy to follow. After I learned how to read the map legend, but, yeah, well, hope your recovery goes well and excited to see what you got next.
Heck yeah. To be determined, I guess.
No ultra signups scrolling yet?
No, not yet.
Good.
Yeah. Yep. Let's take a bit of a break and step back a little bit. We've had a busy 3 months.
Yeah, time to chill.
For sure. I appreciate it, man. Thanks.
Yeah.